Studying these statements by Jesus called the Beatitudes, and they are both a portrait and a promise of a happy or favored slash blessed life. If I handed out the pencils and paper and asked you to draw a portrait of a happy life with yourself at the center of it, I'm guessing you'd look your best whenever that time was. Maybe it's now. Bless you. Enjoy that. You look your best. Maybe you have those around you that you love, those that you wish would love you. You have a nice house, maybe a vacation spot in the background. I don't know what it would look like for you. But you compare that to Jesus's picture, and it's quite different. It's a picture with someone who is actually mourning their spiritual and moral poverty. It's someone that's hungry and thirsty. It's someone that actually weeps over their moral failures. Frederick Bruner has once said, if you could draw a picture of these Beatitudes, illustrate the person in the first four, which are called Beatitudes of Need, you might draw the picture of someone on their knees reaching up to God. The next three would be a picture of someone standing up, reaching out to their neighbor. And the last one about persecution would be someone knocked to their back, reaching up to heaven. It's a different picture, isn't it? I think about how much of my week is devoted not to looking at my need, trying to avoid being needy, trying to win the favor of people. So right off the bat, Jesus gives us a very challenging picture of what happiness looks like. And frankly, I think we would blow it off as unrealistic if he hadn't lived it. Because you begin to look at Jesus' life and you see someone that has lived the Beatitudes. I actually think it would be an interesting thing to do. Read through this list and page through one of the Gospels, Matthew or Luke, and see how the Beatitudes are manifested in his life. But you not only see that, you also see someone that's infinitely and eternally happy. The writer in the book of Hebrews says that actually for the joy set before him, he was willing to be crucified. So it's this both real soberness to life and happiness. It's not a superficial thing. Just recently, in the last couple days, a friend of mine forwarded me one of these spoof advertisements off of YouTube. And it was for the first ever, not antidepressant, but depressant, for the 20 million insufferably cheerful people. Symptoms include squealing on the phone, hugging too much, and excessive use of the phrase, cool beans. It's called Despondex, I think. We all know what superficial happiness looks like. We all know what that looks like. Do we know what it's like to have this picture of the Beatitudes but join happiness together? You really got to look to Jesus for that. And the same is true as we move to this Beatitude. Now we move into what are called the Beatitudes of Action, that's standing up and reaching out. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. And I want to look at two simple questions. What does this mercy involve? And who are the merciful? What does this mercy involve? And who are the merciful? First of all, let's get ourselves a definition of what mercy is. Mercy could be said to be this. It is compassion for the misery which evil and sin has caused. It's compassion for the misery of what evil and sin have done to people and done to the world. And in this way, it differs a bit from the Bible, the idea in the Bible called grace, the concept of grace. In the Bible, grace typically has to do with God's free and full pardon with respect to our guilt and moral failures, where mercy has to do more with the effects of sin. Grace has more to do with the forgiving and the cleansing and the pardoning, mercy with the relieving, the helping, and the healing side of things. And so what it talks about here is God's lavish grace is manifested in the fact that he freely pardons us. It's something you'll spend the rest of your life trying to get your mind around. But even more than that, he's zealous to guard us from the effects of what we've done. And that God, he protects us from many harmful consequences of the silly things that we do and the harmful things that we do. And even when he allows us to feel the consequences of them, he walks along and he bears up beside us. Maybe it's like a parent that has to discipline a child and they say, listen, you know, you've been acting this way all day, you need to clean the bathroom. And then halfway through, they begin to clean the bathroom with them. God comes along and actually begins to bear the effects of it. And there's not anyone in this room that hasn't experienced the mercy of God in that way. And many times I think it comes in such small ways, we wouldn't even recognize it. You know, maybe it's medical help you've received to repair your body, even though it was your harmful living that did it to you. Maybe it's getting off with a warning when you cheated in school or blew through a stop sign. Maybe it's, you know, a relationship that's basically, you sort of blew up. And over time, God is enabled to restore it to you. There's not one of us here that hasn't enjoyed the mercy of God in very small and tangible ways. And for those that actually are followers of God, they even see something else, how God will take the effects and ravage of our sin and actually reverse them and turn them out into redemption. So mercy is not only coming to you, it then begins to work through you. And the very weakness, the very thing perhaps you were ashamed about, becomes, quote unquote, your testimony before people. These have been some of the most powerful moments I've experienced living as a Christian for 20 plus years. Hearing someone stand up and sharing their broken life, and it becomes a ministry to people. This is what God does with the idea of mercy. And that leads us to the second thing, which is, who are the merciful? Who are the ones that Jesus is talking about here? And I want to give it to you with three things. First of all, the merciful are those who experience their own salvation story. They experience their own salvation story. And let me explain what I mean by that. By salvation story, I'm talking about the long story that you read about in the Bible and then works its way out even after the Bible. The long story of God's determination to save and deliver people. And it's a story that maybe could be summed up by the prophet Isaiah in Isaiah 60, where God says, "You shall know that I, the Lord, am your Savior and your Redeemer, the Mighty One of Jacob." The story of the way God pursues people that rebel and wander away. We sang it, "Prone to wander, Lord, I feel it, prone to leave the God I love." And this is the story of the Bible. You can go back to the first story of Adam and Eve. You can move on to Noah and the Ark. You can go to King David. You can go to the Psalms and what they sing about. You can go to the prophets. And what you're hearing is the story of salvation. And that story comes to a climax in the person of Jesus Christ. The prophets would talk about one who was going to come, one who would be the Messiah. When you say Jesus Christ, Christ isn't Jesus' last name. It's his title, the Anointed One. And he's called Jesus because the name Jesus means he'll save his people from their sins. And Jesus very boldly in Luke 24 sets himself in the middle of that story to the dismay of many people. He says, all the lines and stories were pointing to me. But it's not enough to know that story in general. You have to know it personally. And that is the difference there between a religious person and a merciful person. Because blessed are the mercied. It's those that have been received, that have received mercy. Jesus says, those who have been forgiven much are loved much. You find the Apostle Paul appealing to the Roman Christians by saying what? I appeal to you by the mercies of God for those that have experienced mercy. And it was a centerpiece of his life. You can go to 1 Timothy and read where Paul says, I was a blasphemer, I was a perseverer, I was an insolent, obedient, disobedient person. But then God showed me mercy. Paul becomes a great preacher and teacher about the mercy of God. And the mercy that we find in God is just so different than our everyday thing. I mean, we tend to say, if you cross me, you'll be my enemy. If you beg for my mercy, I'll show you conditional mercy. Meaning, I'm going to keep a record in the back of my head here, and I may pull it out and revoke the mercy at any time. In the gospel, you find God showing mercy to those that murdered his son, offering it to people before they even ask, and then saying, upon my name, I will never revoke it from you. This is what the mercy of God is like. John Calvin said this about it. What great occasion God gives us to contemplate his mercy when he often pursues sinners with unwearied kindness, until he shatters their wickedness by imparting benefits and by recalling them to him with more than fatherly kindness. I mean, listen to that phrase there. God who shatters their wickedness by imparting benefits upon them so that he might help them recall his fatherly kindness to them. A wonderful description of the mercy of God. You and I have a tendency when we read stories to skim and gloss over things. And I want to ask you, have you done that with the story of God's mercy in your life? Are you able to recount the story of God's mercy in your life? Or have you really forgotten it? Or maybe you've never even known it. All of us need to be reminded, like the psalmist who says, "Bless the Lord and forget not his benefits. He who forgives your iniquity, redeems your life from the pit, and crowns you with steadfast love and mercy." What a wonderful image of that, to be crowned with the mercy of God. You know, kings and queens typically are lavished with gifts. They're favored, they're lifted up. And the Bible would say that those that have the mercy of God, they are crowned. They're lifted up. God has lavished things upon them. You know, several years ago, the Police had a song, "King of Pain." And I'm sure many of you have heard it. And I've always been drawn to it because I think it speaks so vividly about the loss and the death and the miserable effects of life. But we just can't stop with the story or the song of King of Pain. We need to move to the psalmist, to the King and the Queen of Mercy. Do you understand yourself as a King and Queen of Mercy? You can't get there with a general understanding of God's mercy. It has to be a personal understanding of God's mercy. I wonder this week if you got yourself a good cup of coffee and grabbed a journal, and you might sit down and begin to write the story of God's mercy in your life. Maybe it would start slow. If you can't think of anything, well, there you've learned something right off the bat. Your heart is sort of crusty. That's okay. Our hearts are crusty all the time. Maybe you would let up a little prayer and say, "Will you warm my heart and show me one thing?" And you'll go, "You know, someone was kind to me last week when I was, when I was struggling. Someone let me into traffic when I was late." I don't know what it would be. But would you begin to write a story of God's personal mercy in your life? For those people that do, I think you're going to have two results. One is you're going to move from just sort of being hopeful about mercy to being confident about the mercy of God. You go to Psalm 23. It's the psalm that everybody reads at funerals. It's a great psalm to read at funerals because you don't need mercy any more than you do when you're standing before that grave. And what does the psalmist have the audacity to say? He doesn't go, "Well, I hope mercy will follow me the days of my life." He goes, "Surely mercy and goodness will follow me all the days of my life." The only reason you'll ever be able to say that is if you transfer your hope for mercy from yourself to God. If your hope for mercy is basically on you, you're going to have a very thin and weak and trickling mercy. You move it to God, you realize it's based in his character. When God wanted to summarize who he was before Israel, he said, "I'll say it to you in a sentence. The Lord, full of steadfast love and mercy." He also said he was holy. Full of mercy. The second thing it does, it begins to turn us into merciful people. We become merciful people. We stop protecting ourselves from people's needs, which we'll tend to do. Because God has met us in this low place and we have been wrapped around with his mercy, we stop protecting ourselves. The other thing is when we go to show mercy, we won't do so in a patronizing way or a paternalistic way. And this is especially an important issue when we talk about what it means to show mercy in the under-resourced parts of our city. I'm currently reading a book called When Helping Hurts. And it's a book out of the Chalmers Institute at Covenant College. And one of the things they talk about there is a big problem when you get into the idea of quote-unquote mercy ministry is really a patronizing and paternalistic way that people with resources can approach those that are in need. And they say we really need to recall the ABCDs of mercy: asset-based community development. And asset-based means you go into a community and go, "What assets are already here? What gifts are here? What resources are here? What talents are here?" You're appealing to the people. Another one is called appreciative inquiry, where the people go into the community and say, "Recall the positive history of this place, beyond the blightedness and the hard times." And I'd like that for three reasons. Number one, it reckons right off the bat that these are image bearers before me. These are people that have assets. These are people that have gifts just like me. Number two, it reminds us that God has been at work long before we ever showed up. And number three, it guards people from going as saviors and has them go as peers. The mercy of God has everything to do with down-to-earth things like how does community development happen? And how does a community approach that? Let's now talk about the second. So those who are mercy, first of all, understand their salvation story. Second of all, they understand that mercy is a weighty matter of God's law. It's a weighty matter. If we fast-forward it up to chapter 23 in the book of Matthew, you would hear a conflict between Jesus and the religious leaders of the day. They're called the Pharisees and the scribes. And he gets after them because they were meticulous in obeying the smallest laws, even tithing herbs, mint and dill. But they totally missed the plight of those that were in great need. And this is what Jesus says to them. He's actually condemning them at this point. He pulls out the woes. And when Jesus pulls out the woes, it's not good. It's not good. He says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint and dill and cumin and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness. These you ought to have done without neglecting the others, you blind guides, straining out a gnat and swallowing a camel." And Jesus is just following the line of the prophets, Hosea, where God says, "I desire mercy instead of rather than sacrifice." God isn't saying, "I don't want you to do sacrifices." He's the one that told them to do them. He's saying, "I want you to reckon with the weightier matters of the law. Mercy, justice. Are these weighty? Do they weigh upon your heart as much as anything else does? Weighty matters of the law." And what's striking about this, in both those passages, Hosea and here, is that Jesus is not talking to irreligious people. He's talking to religious experts, very religious people. Religious people disconnected from the mercy of God are possibly the most merciless people on the face of the planet. Those religious folk disconnected from the mercy of God are possibly the most merciless people around. And it only makes sense. If you don't believe your justification and ground before people in God is grace and mercy, you will inevitably believe it is because of your good moral performance. And here we can move right outside of religious life and just say, you know, your standard may not be a religious standard. It may be a work ethic that you serve, a standard of your family, a standard of the culture, whatever it would be. It's the same deal straight across the board. It's the idea that I recommend myself by my good performance. If your ground is not mercy and grace, it will have to be that. And it will yield two things. One, it yields applying the law to people in a merciless way, where you're constantly pointing out their faults because of the standard that you have. I think it's cloaked in the attitude or phrase, "I only ask of people what I expect of myself. I only ask of people what I expect of myself." Isn't it often the case, I've found this personally, that when someone appears dull or deaf to my criticisms, and so I keep lobbing them, that's really not the case. At some point when they can't take it anymore, they go, "Don't you know that I'm aware of that weakness?" I've had my own wife say it to me at times, and it's so convicting, "Don't you know I'm not good at that? I don't need you to tell me." It's often the case. Case that we're not aware, because it's this dynamic where the law is just finally and always applied to people. And what do we find with Jesus? It's the exact opposite. Jesus is the holiest person on the planet. I think someone, at least a religious person, would say, "Well, you know, he hit the mark pretty well." And what is said of him in Hebrews chapter 4? He is a great and merciful high priest. He knows what it feels like to be tempted, and so people come to him with their weaknesses. They desire to come near to him for their weaknesses because of his mercy. It's a very different thing. The second thing, I think, that idea of mercy not being the greatest law, but my performance being the greatest law yields, is basically disdaining people because they don't live up to your standard. You just inevitably will disdain people because they don't match and make that standard. And I think this gets captured in the phrase and attitude, why can't people just pull themselves up by their bootstraps? Why can't they pull themselves up from their situation? Maybe it happens in the home by saying, why can't you just do what I said? You know, why do you have this weakness? Why don't you just pull it off? And it really moves out, I think, into the larger conversation of how many times resourced people can refer to under-resourced or poor people. It's those of us here that have been raised in middle to upper class homes are going to be most tempted to see things like that. To maybe say that phrase, why don't people just pull themselves up by their bootstraps? And what it reveals, I was having a lunch with one of our members this week, and we were both talking about this. You know, behind that attitude, number one, tends to be a blindness to everything that went into your environment to help you to succeed. You know, this idea of why doesn't someone pull themselves up by the bootstraps is typically, why doesn't someone be like me? And so it's someone that's believed that their success is really due to themselves. They fail to see the education, the nurturing environment they had, the networks they had, the money at their disposal, and they also tend to be blind to the margin of error they enjoy. That they can risk and they can fail and basically sort of get bailed out. It's one thing to take a risk and maybe in this economy hurt your retirement or hurt your saving. It's another thing to be out on the street. Very different margin of error. Now, people that begin to understand the mercy of God, I think there's a different effect. One, it results in a humble, compassionate person on the weaknesses of other people. Maybe instead of this idea, I only expect what, you know, I expect of myself, there becomes love covers a multitude of sins. We begin to go, you know, what does it look like to have compassion upon someone in their weakness? We begin to reflect upon our own story and our own lives. I was recalling a conversation I had with a dean of students at Covenant Seminary when I was going to seminary. And he once said to a group of us, and he was talking about, we were on a leadership team, what it means to have to love fellow grad students that sometimes are very hard to love. And he said, in my experience, I've found out that often the most irritating and annoying people have the deepest wounds once you get into their story. Part of the reason why they're sort of acting that way. Maybe we begin to look at people's behavior differently with a leaning toward compassion. I think it yields that. But I think someone that actually sees the mercy of God yields this. They're not only sensitized to the mercy of God, but it begins to prioritize the way they see things. We've said this from beginning at this church. As you said, there are so many ways a church can get pulled, especially in this town. So many important issues. Lots of issues. But we had this commitment that if we lift up this idea of Jesus' mercy and the grace of God, it will order our priorities. It will order things. It will guard you. And I'm not just sort of making this up. What does Paul say? I preached Christ and Him crucified. I've ordered everything under that. It guards you and I from taking minor things and making them major things, from missing the weightier matters of the law, the weightiest thing of the law, the glory of the Son of God, who shows grace and comes in mercy. It guards us. It will protect us. Now, the question I know lingering in the back of your minds, and it lingers in mine as I was studying this, what about personal responsibility? You know, are you saying that mercy excuses everything? And I want to address that in one second, but I'm going to say this, because, again, we're so prone to the other direction. The moment you ask that question, what about personal responsibility, you better immediately think about all the ways that you fail in personal responsibility. You just have to, or your pride will distort you. Let me read to you something that an old theologian, B.B. Warfield, a Presbyterian theologian that lived in the last century, said. He was talking about the issue that we're talking about, and he was answering objections. This is what he said. Objection number one, my money is my own. Answer, Christ might have said. By the way, he's addressing particularly those that are professing Christians. Objection one, my money is my own. Answer, Christ might have said, my blood is my own. Then where should we have been? Objection number two, the poor are undeserving. Answer, Christ gave his blood for the undeserving. Objection number three, The poor may abuse it. Answer, Christ might have said the same, yea, with far greater truth. Christ knew that thousands would trample his blood under their feet, that most would despise it, that many would make it an excuse for sinning more. Yet he gave his own blood. Oh, my dear Christians, if you would be like Christ, give much, give often, give freely to the vile and poor, the thankless and undeserving. Christ is glorious and happy, and so will you be. Did you hear yourself reflected in any of those questions? I did. We need to do that before we get to the question, what about personal responsibility? But we can get to that question. Does mercy exclude personal responsibility? Just the opposite. Mercy begins to recognize it. Truth and mercy are not exclusive. For instance, in that model I mentioned, asset-based community development, I mean, right there, the moment you begin to recognize people's assets, of course after that, you're going to be saying, what about your obligation to the assets you've been given? About your talents, about your gifts, about your story. Of course it's going to lead there. That's where all image bearers of God should go, that place. But consider this, you can't determine that obligation outside of relationships. You can't determine that outside of relationships, because relationships have a whole story involved. We have no idea about the struggles and what went before and what went after. And that's why when anybody makes a statement, you know, why doesn't someone just pull themselves up by the bootstraps, you need to ask, are you in relationship with anybody? Because that's a very simplistic statement. We find ourselves at that point. Of course, personal responsibility plays into it, but only in the context of relationship. This law is so weighty, Jesus says, that it's only the merciful that will get mercy. He tells two parables that drive this home. The parable of the unmerciful servant, the guy gets forgiven a great debt, right? Then he goes out and strangles the person who owes him a few coins. He says that guy actually gets thrown out into the darkness. And let's not forget the parable of the Good Samaritan, about the guy that, you know, went to the person bleeding and dying and cared for them. That parable is told in response to what question? What do I have to do to inherit eternal life? Now, maybe some of us are in this tradition would say, well, I would expect that Jesus to point me to the Westminster Confession answer on justification at that point. He doesn't. Now, what am I saying here? That the mercy of God is merited? No. The mercy of God is not a necessary condition, or rather, showing mercy isn't a necessary condition for salvation. It is a necessary consequence. It is a necessary consequence. Jesus is saying, if the mercy of God isn't streaming and growing in someone's life, you should not be confident. You should not be confident that you've grasped the mercy of God. It's very bold. I don't want to qualify it too much because Jesus doesn't. But let's go to the last thing. And that is, so understanding mercy has to do with understanding your salvation story, understanding mercy is a weightier matter of God's law. But lastly, understanding mercy is action. Mercy is more than good intentions. It's more than sincerity. The book of James would say that sort of thing is false religion. But what does it begin to look like? Well, it's two things. One, I think it means being emotionally involved. The Vulgate, which is an ancient Latin translation, actually translate this beatitude as happy are the misery-hearted. Happy are the misery-hearted. Those that have been willing to feel the misery of other people deep into their heart. John Calvin had said that this beatitude, happy are the people that are willing to be troubled for more than their own troubles. Will be troubled by other people. And as we said last week, I think it means emotionally putting yourself into shoes of people, allowing yourself to feel things. And I confess, it's overwhelming in our age with things that are coming through the media, and you open up the paper. You know, we'll get to that in a second. It's overwhelming. But it means allowing your heart to be touched. So you sit there and go, all right, homeless children. What does a homeless child experience? They typically have nightmares. They typically deal with bedwetting, violent mood swings, severe depression. They lose 1 to 3 months of school every time they're moved and typically have to move 5 times a year. You begin to go, what if that were my challenge? What if that were my child? What if that was my nephew, my niece? We have to begin to feel those things, emotionally get into people's shoes. Because that's what the great high priest does. That's what I love about that passage. Jesus knows what it's like to feel the burdens of people. But he does more than feel. It leads to action. If you go to the book of Isaiah, chapter 53, it's a passage about the Messiah. And listen to what it says about the Messiah. He has borne our griefs, carried our sorrows, crushed our iniquities. His stripes are we healed by. Did you hear the emphasis? He took on my junk. He entered into my world. It's only in the Christian faith that, you know, God doesn't stand up in heaven and take his tear-drenched hanky and just wring it over the earth. He sends the Son of God to earth. And he doesn't stand off in a palace and say, I'll see poor people now. I'll see the wretched and sinful now. He goes in. He becomes that. He walks. He identifies to the point where he bears the guilt, bears the iniquity, the diseases he takes, the punishment he takes, the chastisement he takes. You'll only find that in the Christian faith. I say that respectfully, but you know, if you question that, I'd love to have a conversation with you about that. But you find Jesus identifying. He is the great deacon, Romans 15. But it doesn't stop there, because when Jesus rises up to the earth, who takes his place? You! Me! This is why one of the names of the church is called the body of Christ. That's the ministry of mercy. Where does mercy take action? I said this before, I'm less comfortable saying in my life, someone do something. I hear the voice of the Holy Spirit saying to me, something called the church. And as the church moves out, there are three things I think we have to remember. One, that we're called to a comprehensive mercy. Tim Keller, when he reflects on the Good Samaritan, says, when you think about it, there's some significant steps. First of all, there's emergency medical treatment, there's transportation, there's financial assistance, and then there's a follow-up visit. All those things that happen together. You know, folks that write on community development, you know, say there's three R's: relief, rehabilitation, and reconstruction. All through those things. And sometimes a community is more adept at one than the other. But we need to keep in mind that, you know, yes, relief is something that usually comes with great tragedy right off the bat. Rehabilitation is going in where parts of the system have just run things down. The effects of sin have ground things down. Reconstruction, equipping, and building people. But mercy is to be comprehensive. But that leads to the second thing, and that is, it's complex, isn't it? You don't have to live in the city long and scratch your head and go, how do I deal with this? I was talking to one of our missionaries, Anna Garriott, and she spent a good bit of time with community development. We were both saying, boy, isn't that where the rub is? The complexity of showing mercy. You know, and let me just say, I really think we need to borrow that phrase that our good friend Steve Garber gave us, those that you know him, where he said, put the word proximate before everything in this life. Because the Bible teaches that this ain't going to be utopia. It is anything but a call to just sit back. You won't find that anywhere in the Bible. But there's a sanity that says there'll be proximate happiness. There'll be proximate justice. There'll be proximate mercy. Because it's complex. And if we can't learn to live in the complexity, you'll basically ride the wave of Washington, D.C., which is naive optimism to cynicism. And I don't know where you are in that wave right now. And the truth is, I think all of us just keep riding it. But it leads to the third thing that I think is critical that we understand. I've said comprehensive, planned, complex, but consummation. Isn't it great that I could give you a third C? Consummation. And in consummation, we realize that only God has the muscle to complete the job. And actually, he has a jealousy to complete the job. He is the one, and why wouldn't he just wash his hands of the world and say, listen, you made your bed, lie in it. I'll forgive you, but you're going to live with the consequences. Instead, he is the one that says, all my purposes are moving to a place where mercy and shalom will come to its fullness. Hear the promise of Revelation. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore. The leaves of the tree of life will be the healing of the nations. There is a day of culmination, and it's not pie in the sky, because Jesus resurrected from the dead. The one that showed mercy and died under the weight of it comes to life. And this is what energized that early church. You got to have some explanation for that. What got these people that were defeated, hiding in a room, up and going? They saw a resurrected man who was no longer laboring under those things. And that culmination helps us to keep going, because as you got your shoulder to the plow, you got one eye to the city that's right over the hill. It helps us live with the complexity. It'll help us live with the heartbreaking stories in our own lives and the lives of our neighbors in this city. It'll enable us to keep showing hard mercy. Blessed are those that are merciful. Let's pray. God, we thank you so much for sending Jesus, the great deacon, the great merciful high priest. Thank you for what you do with a group of people that are ragtag. Thank you for the story of salvation you've given us. Would you please help us to maintain the weightier matters of the law? And would you please move us into action for the long haul? And we ask it in your name. Amen.